all that matters is...
Wrong!
This town deserves a better class.
Heavy Metal Podcast.
And I'm gonna give it...
If you do not listen, then the hell with you.
Walk through the gate of consciousness. Stop from drop from under you.
Run,
a message from your favorite German emperor and mine, Kaiser Wilhelm II.
A momentous hour has struck for Germany. Envious rivals everywhere have forced the sword into our hands. War will demand enormous sacrifices by the German people. Not me so much, but more in the you area. You guys who are not me. Just to be clear. But today, we have all gathered to pray for the triumph of our weapons, and we shall show the enemy what it means to attack Germany, even if technically we attacked first. It's still an attack by them, still counts, they still suck. If our neighbors do not give us peace, then we hope and wish that our good German sword will come victorious out of this war. This sword, gesture to sword. Oh, I'm not supposed to read that part. This sword, which I have held in its scabbard for decades, shall decide. And it has literally been there for decades, because I got kind of a gammy hand. I mean, I have people to unsheath it if I really wanted to. I just don't right now. Our ancient fame is an appeal to the German people and their sword. The entire German nation, to the last man, has grasped the sword. Have I mentioned the sword yet? Have I talked about it so far in this speech? Okay, good. Just making sure we're on the same page. And so I draw this sword with the help of God. And probably this guy. What's your name? Klaus? Okay. Could you grab this sword and kind of lift it in the air for me, like triumphantly, you know? More triumphant? Okay, now less triumphant? Split the difference? Okay, yeah, that's the right amount of triumph right there. And so I draw the sword with the help of God. And Chris here. It was Chris, right? Klaus? Whatever, it's Chris now. The sword is drawn, and I cannot sheath it again without victory and honor. Well, victory, honor, and Chris here, but... You get what I'm saying. Okay, good speech. Let's all go out and die for me, yeah? Oh, by the by, you know England? The country we're going to war with? Their queen is my grandmother.
Weird, right? Like, what's the point of all this, then? Anyway.
Have fun with the death and stuff. Wilhelm out, bitches!
Wow. That was really inspiring. And believe it or not, was taken from actual speeches by Kaiser Wilhelm II in 1914 during the run-up to the First World War. Well, not all of it, obviously, but that sword shit? Yeah, dude loved that one metaphor really hard. He also had one arm that was about 15 centimeters shorter than the other and was an actual idiot. None of it was his fault, of course. It was probably due to a butt truck of generational inbreeding and the doctors who chloroformed the shit out of his mom during labor. Yeah, it was a rocky start, but after that, they gave him every chance in the world. Those same doctors tried to fix his arm at a young age by regularly giving him what they called animal baths, where they would shove his withered limb into the carcass of a freshly slaughtered animal for science. Weirdly, it didn't fix the arm, and he did end up with a ton of emotional problems, but who could have seen that coming? Anyway, I knew we were going to be talking about war today, so I wanted to start off on something of a lighter note. Mission accomplished. And welcome to And Volume 4 All, a deeply reverent and lovingly irreverent exploration of the history, philosophy, and future of the greatest music in the world, heavy metal. I am your host, Apocalyptic Hellscape, Quinn. Have I used that one before? Oh, that sounds familiar. And we are on part two of our multi-part deep doggy paddle into World War I through the lens of heavy metal. So let's pick back up where we left off, which is right before one of the worst places to be in the history of the world. Europe, 1914. So the speeches that I lent my uncanny powers of transformation to at the top of this episode were part of the German effort to mobilize their population in preparation for war. And they clearly chose the right guy for the job. Sure, Wilhelm II had the mental capacity of an oxygen-deprived Dalmatian, but who needs the smart when you got confidence, childhood trauma, and a super weird mustache? But luckily for the Germans, he wasn't really in charge of their national defense. Now, the brilliant military strategist behind the German Empire's plan for preemptive war was a guy named Alfred von Schlieffen, who authored the eponymous Schlieffen Plan in 1905 that would become Germany's opening salvo in the war to end all wars 9 years later, and who was dead. But as we know, the vision never dies, and so Schlieffen's plan became the official blueprint both for how to begin and to quickly end the Great War in the minds of German military officials. The strategy itself was built upon the principle of speed, the idea being that with France to the west and Russia to the east, the German forces would be best served taking France out first before turning to face Russia and quickly bringing them to peace terms. Now, I don't know if this next metaphor was included in the actual text of the Schlieffen Plan, but I honestly don't see how it couldn't have been. It goes like this. Germany thinks of itself as World Boxing Association upstart Little Mac, who has been unfortunately sandwiched between two other contenders, Glass Joe in France and King Hippo in Russia. Yeah, Soda Popinski is a better cultural parallel, but now he's available for your heavy metal podcast about World War I using Mike Tyson's Punch-Out to explain the Schlieffen Plan. Germany knows King Hippo is the tougher fight, but he's also slow as shit. So the plan is to serve Glass Joe a hat trick of star punches that he so clearly wants out of life, and nab that TKO before King Hippo can even get his trunks up. Then Little Mac can just wail away at the vasectomy bandage on Hippo's fupa, the definition of non-essential surgery there, until Mario crowns Germany King of Europe. Apologies if this is making too much sense. But in order to get to France, Germany can only go through the southern border the two countries share, which France is heavily fortified for some reason, or through the neutral kingdom of Belgium. So now Germany has to make a decision. And they do not waffle. Or I guess they do, because they choose Belgium. Isn't it crazy how well this is going? Crossing through neutral territory to preemptively attack a sovereign nation is just the first of a long list of fucked up things the Germans will do in World War I, and it's made even more egregious by the way they cross through. The Empire was expecting little to no resistance in Belgium, so when they faced a fairly robust defense, Germany kinda went off, indiscriminately killing upwards of 5,000 Belgian civilians and setting fires to every building in their path, including a medieval university in Louvain. Germany was trying to prevent a popular resistance among the Belgians, which I guess kinda worked on about 5,000 of them. But the parade of horrors left in their wake had the unintended consequence of kicking off a campaign of propaganda against Germany as a nation of bloodthirsty, inhuman barbarians. And personally, I liked Bloodthirsty, Inhuman Barbarians' first three records before they shit the bed and went all electropop. But this is where the bromide of Germans as the Hun comes from. The half-man, half-ape climbing through your bedroom window, drooling blood and forcing your innocent children to put verbs at the beginning of questions. Real gruesome shit. Dehumanization of an enemy populace is pretty par for the course when it comes to war propaganda, and it's not like every other country wasn't doing the same thing. Belgium just gave the US, UK, and France a pretext to argue that the cruelty was somehow innate to those people who lived on the other side of that imaginary border we made up 50 years ago. I mean, it's all fairly transparent horseshit. Brutality is no more a fundamental feature of the German people than it is of the accountant people or any other arbitrary category we invented in the last 200,000 years of human history. What the Germans did in Belgium is what people do in war. And compared to what was on the horizon in World War I, the atrocities of Belgium were mostly in line with what Europe had come to expect of its land wars. The last time these same countries got together to talk about their feelings, it ended with the Battle of Waterloo a century earlier, which took the lives of somewhere between 10 and 20,000 soldiers in just about 9 hours. Now that said, those were soldiers and not civilians, which is why I think the Allied propaganda imploring their citizens to halt the Hun was so resonant. And I hope the Allies didn't throw away any of those posters after 1918 because they're just going to need them again in about 20 years. The big point I'm trying to make here is that the kickoff to World War I was utterly unconscionable. But the envelope of brutality that Germany would continue to push until 1945 wasn't because the German people were just a constitutionally unique subset of human with a higher threshold for evil shit. You're thinking of marketing executives. And if we don't fight them on their streets, soon we'll have to fight them on ours. If in 2024 I were to argue that France was a nation of unreformable warmongers, I would likely be laughed out of the UN Security Council, and I can't let that happen again. But if I were to make that argument in 1815, after a decade and a half of Napoleon trying to compensate by standing on a pile of dead Englishmen, I might get something of a warmer welcome. But 19th century Frenchmen and 20th century Germans weren't a uniquely inhumane subspecies of Homo sapien. They were just people. World War I was a horrifying revelation about the future of modern warfare and our capacity for indifference to human suffering on an unprecedented scale, but not because humanity itself had changed in any way. What changed were the parameters in which we were allowed to wage war on one another. And that is what the world is about to learn as German forces make their way toward France by way of Belgium in 1914. But 108 years later, a Belgian black metal band called Suntold released an album devoted entirely to World War I titled World Torn Asunder. I think you can hear the echoes of that fateful and fatal crossing a little over a century ago off of the album's fifth track, Dulce et Decorum Est. That song's title is borrowed from a poem written by an English soldier who fought in World War I named Wilfred Owen, who in turn borrowed the phrase from the Roman poet Horace. Owen's poem is a graphic description of a friend's death as the result of a gas attack. I'm going to read you a section from the end, and then we will get into the song's lyrics, which I think offer an interesting contrast. Here's Owen's treatment. Under a green sea, I saw him drowning. In all my dreams before my helpless sight, he plunges at me, guttering, choking, drowning. If in some smothering dreams, you too could pace behind the wagon that we flung him in and watch the white eyes writhing in his face, if you could hear at every jolt the blood come gargling from froth-corrupted lungs, obscene as cancer, bitter as the cud of vile, incurable sores on innocent tongues. My friend, you would not tell with such high zest to children ardent for some desperate glory the old lie. Dulce et decorum est, pro patri mori. The Latin phrase that Owen repurposed from Horace for the conclusion of his poem in English means, it is sweet and fitting to die for one's country. Suntold seems to have taken on the interior monologue of the poem's subject, the dying man himself and his final regrets, having left a family and specifically a daughter at home as he dies in an unknown world. I miss my child's voice. I miss the way she looked at me. Her smile lowered to hate when we said our goodbyes and the man I came to be. The darkest hour was just before dawn when the bullets came across from beyond the sun. I hold your necklace tight in this waking hour. Within this hour, in this final hour, I said goodbye. I feel her breath on my heartstrings. I died for my country. I think most people who heard this song without reading the lyrics or knowing the impetus behind them would never imagine that they were as sorrowful and heartrending as I think they are. But that's because, as Samuel Beckett reminds us, people are bloody ignorant apes. And speaking of people, there's a great website. Yeah, I know, it's a shit transition, but there's nothing I can really do here. It's the Kobayashi Maru of transitions. But I don't believe in the no-win scenario. I just release it every few weeks as a podcast. So there's this great website that I should give props to that was a good starting place for researching this series. It's called Google. No, I'm kidding. It's a music database called Rate Your Music that hosts the page World War I themed albums curated by a user named Serendipidian. So I wanted to give them a shout out for helping me find a lot of the music for this series.
Thanks, Serendipidian!
I never know if I'm supposed to literally shout a shout-out or not, so I'm just covering all my bases here. Okay, back to the front. Believe it or not, the Schlieffen Plan was actually Germany's way of trying to avoid World War I. They believed that they could take Paris in 6 weeks before Russia could mobilize its forces against them in the east. Well, it turned out that King Hippo was more of a soda pop insky after all, mobilizing an attack on East Prussia in just 4 weeks, and Glass Joe over in France turned out to be more of a bald bull. Or I suppose France would prefer Macho Man, because, you know, France. Also, the Belgians put up one hell of a fight on their border at the Battle of Liège. Germany marched on Belgium on August 5th, but were held at the outskirts for 11 days until their artillery could clear the way. That gave both France enough time to strengthen its defenses and the British Expeditionary Forces the time to swim across the Channel and enjoy a spot of Earl Grey before charging to the Western Front to kick some Krauthaus. Or Aus, as the case may be. It's weird that they insist on adding an R, but refuse to pronounce it. The chief of the German general staff, a man named Helmut von Moltke the Younger, or Helmut Quincy Moltke, as he's known in the States, which is a joke because we don't know him in the States. He was the guy in charge of executing the Schlieffen Plan, and he wasn't anticipating the English at all. The German military thought that the war would be over before Russia and England could even get there. It was like planning to show up at a friend's birthday just to drop off a present and then bounce to avoid seeing a girlfriend who you know is always late but will definitely be there. But when you roll up, she and the girl you dumped so you could date her are both there hanging streamers.
Oh, hey, England, what's up? Is France around? I was just going to drop off some artillery shells for him because I got to go. I got a thing later.
Well, well, well. If it isn't Mr. Let's Make Money Babies.
Russia, what's going on, girl? So you in England, you know each other.
That's weird.
Worlds collide, right? Anyway, is France around at his own birthday party? Is it just people who've seen my dick? Because I have a stupid present, so...
He went to the grocery to pick up more wine for the party, Deutschland. Nice to see you haven't changed. Still coming too soon, eh?
Ah, oh yeah. And you haven't lost your sense of humor, England. Just your looks. Okay, tell him I'll fucking mail it.
Any resemblance to actual persons living or still wishing me dead is purely coincidental. And much like the unfortunate social scenario I just enacted, this is where shit starts to get ugly. But before we get there, as Germany is announcing to the world that Europe's fan was now thoroughly drenched in Scheiße, other countries started jumping into the fight. Some as a bulwark against the militarism of the Central Powers like Serbia, Japan, and the fictional country of Montenegro. And some who just wanted a piece of that sweet, sweet Central Power action like the Ottoman Empire, who were tired of feeling like the world's footstool. You had to know that was coming, right? I mean, otherwise, what are we doing here? And finally, some countries watched in horror as Belgium burned, and the Battle of the Frontiers raged, wherein, over the course of a single month, the English suffered nearly 30,000 killed or wounded, the French 260,000, and Germany, who were the victors, over 300,000. Those countries who bore horrifying witness to such unthinkable losses knew they could not sit idle any longer. So they bravely chose to stand idle by declaring themselves neutral. Yes, Sweden, Switzerland, and most notably Italy and the United States spoke with one voice, the voice of the heart, crying out unambiguously, "Maybe. I mean, we'll see." As Germany continued its push toward Paris with plans to surround and annihilate the French army in what Alfred von Schlieffen called Schlacht ohne Morgen, or War Without Tomorrow, the Western Front really started to accelerate into total war. And that term, total war, doesn't just mean a really bad war. There had been really bad wars in the past, but total war was something almost entirely new in 1914. French historian David A. Bell argued in a book that I definitely didn't read that the Napoleonic Wars of the 18th century were the first to introduce aspects of total war, like mass military conscription. The practice of total war happens to coincide with the Industrial Revolution because part of the term means that combatants consider all resources and infrastructure of a society as legitimate military targets. And you kind of have to have infrastructure in order for someone to target it. One of the other major features of total war is prioritizing warfare over all other needs of society. And in fact, it utilizes the needs of the people for the explicit purpose of making war. Something I want to keep pointing out, and I think one of the reasons that metal has adopted World War I as such a frequent and specific topic for critique, is that while aspects of total war have been part of human conflict as far back as Genghis Khan's lifelong campaign of terror on the Asian continent, the full retinue of tactics employed during total war had never been seen on such full and complete display as they were in the years between 1914 and 1918. I referenced Waterloo earlier, and that battle was an absolute shock to the European system. 50,000 casualties in a single day is an absolutely gobsmacking figure. Now, just to be clear, the term casualties means killed or wounded. The number of confirmed dead, as I said earlier, is somewhere above 10,000 and probably well below 20,000. But Waterloo was famously the end of the Napoleonic Wars. July 1st, 1916. The first day of the Battle of the Somme, which we'll get to, resulted in 57,000 casualties for the British alone. And the battle continued on the next day, and the next, and the next, and didn't conclude until the 18th of November, 5 months later, when the total number of casualties for all sides reached somewhere around 1.2 million. Take a breath. Music is coming, I promise. One last lengthy point, though, first. I found this great and terrible website from Oxford University that analyzed casualties of war throughout human history. It has charts and graphs and articles analyzing everything that you'd want to know about stuff you wish had never happened. And there is one animated chart that just put everything in really stark relief for me. The y-axis, the uppy-downy one, shows casualties by the millions. And the x-axis, the lefty-righty one, shows the year dating back to 1800. Once you press play, the animation looks like tiny waves throughout history until you get to 1812, and the Napoleonic Wars suddenly make the waves look like little one- and two-story homes on either side of a skyscraper. It's a pretty stunning visual, but then the chart returns to semi-normalcy for about a century, what historians and late middle-aged dads call Pax Britannia. But the moment 1914 enters the screen, you suddenly lose track of the skyscraper at the center of the little huts because the animation has to zoom so far out that almost every year prior virtually disappears. I'm going to post the chart on Twitter when the episode is published so y'all can give it a watch. Or not, if you like sleeping. Because if the appearance of the Napoleonic Wars is, the way I described it, stunning, World War I, as represented by the motion graphic of that chart, feels like a glitch in reality. I'd never truly understood what World War meant as a novel moment in human history before that. But it really did alter my conception of not just the two world wars, but the idea of war itself. And before we zoom back into the minutiae of history, if it can be called that, and it can, because it just did, I think it might be time for some music.
What with this being a program on songs and such?
As I was going down the rabbit hole of total war as a concept, the little cop in my head started harassing me about it.
All right, McQuinner. They've heard enough of your philosophy and fisticuffs. It's time to be getting back to the meat of the matter, you daft gobshite.
And while I'm typically more than grateful for Lieutenant Hallahead's good counsel, as well should be you, that guy saved you from a 10-minute tangent on the Italian Renaissance during the Future of Metal episodes that you would have never gotten back. But no one cheers the hero who prevents a disaster, do they? The more I thought about the idea of what total war really means on a human scale, I started to realize that that is exactly the proverbial meat of the matter.
I'll be the judge of that, you right plank.
Lieutenant, I think that guy over there was drinking Guinness.
That's not a crime, McQuinner.
Yeah, but he didn't finish it.
Why, the Jack Heen, I'll shatter his kneecaps a while.
He fucking will, too. The total nature of World War I makes it such a massive subject that it's actually impossible to conceive of on a human scale. To put it really stupid, there are just too many humans involved. Now, most of the metal bands that I'm featuring in this series have approached that challenge in a similar way, by trying to isolate a specific aspect of the war, a battle or a series of battles, even an entire operation or front in the conflict, like how Minenwerfer wrote an entire album on naval warfare, or Alpenpasse on the White War. Feuerwalzer is entirely focused on the First Battle of the Somme, which highlights a historically significant section of the war as a way of articulating, processing, or deconstructing the horrors of war as a larger concept. It's like they want to understand the Milky Way galaxy, so they're studying our solar system and then applying what they've learned to the larger model. And now all I can see is a lab full of scientists in corpse paint. Tor, do you have the numbers on the Hawking radiation from Sagittarius A?
Yes, voila, come on.
That means my data set is off by at least Kelvin. Okay, I'll keep digging. But then there are bands who've approached the subject in an entirely different way. And while neither is necessarily better than the other, some of my favorite acts in metal have chosen to forgo the specifics of history and instead zoom all the way down to the quantum in hopes of finding what it is in us humans on a fundamental, even biological level that would allow for the possibility of something like total war to even exist. If the artists in this series, mostly, are studying the solar system to unlock the secrets of the Milky Way, the next set of musicians are investigating the atom as a way of decoding the entirety of the universe. Scientifically, it's not dissimilar to discovering one simple formula that describes an infinite number of phenomena. For example, is there a common denominator between sunshine, the age of dinosaur bones, and how cell phones work? And spoiler alert, there is! Energy equals mass times the speed of light multiplied by itself, or E equals mc squared. Four values on either side of an equal sign can tell you about basically every interaction between everything in the entire universe. Now, how did I get to the theory of relativity by way of Swedish black metal? I have no idea. I assumed it was your fault. Where is Lieutenant Hallahead when I need him? I mean, how long does it take to cripple a man for life? Whatever. You know what? He's the pro. So I put together a little medley for you.
You know how I love my medleys.
From four bands attempting to understand the common denominator among events as distinct from one another as, say, the Mongol siege of Baghdad and the Native American genocide by way of one simple human equation. And we'll talk about it a bit on the other side. But in all the heaviness here, don't ignore the distinct presence of sorrow that I think runs through all of these tracks. Okay. I've jabbered enough. We begin with progressive sludge jazz metal band from California. No, you heard me right. Off of their debut record in 2008, Prehistoricisms. This is Intronaut with a song titled The Literal Black Cloud.
We'll be right back.
God, how has it taken me this long to play Gojira? What kind of deeply reverent and lovingly irreverent exploration of the history, philosophy, and future of the greatest music in the world is this anyway? So we started with Intronaut, a progressive band that have always included polyrhythms into their sound by way of the drums, but also extended instrumental jazz breaks that have kind of transitioned into vocal melodies mixed with harsh vocals, as you heard there, as they develop their discography. The opening lyrics repeat again at the end of the track and read like this. There are too many rules to follow. Sheep play war games in the literal black cloud. And the background vocals during the jazzy breakdown there are these. And in your perspiration, it absorbs. A cycle as old as one's life is long. You breathe in the filth, and in you, it absorbs. Intronaut seems to be saying that the rules of conflict break down within the fog of war, the literal black cloud of the title. And those conditions are then absorbed and perpetuated by the individual, the sheep, who breathe in the filth. It's kind of making the point I was earlier about war as a permission structure for releasing our worst impulses. There are repeated themes in all four of these songs that, believe it or not, I didn't really recognize until I put them all together, and I wonder if you won't start to pick up on them a bit quicker than I did. Following Intronaut is one of my favorite albums from one of my favorite bands, the Swedish post-metal outfit that I've played often on the pod, Cult of Luna. The song is I, the Weapon, the single off of Vertical, their sixth studio album released in 2013. Vertical's a concept album about the black and white film by Fritz Lang, Metropolis. While not explicitly about war, the record revolves around themes of industrial dehumanization. And I, the Weapon, implies that the mechanization of the human animal is for the purposes of war. Listen to this. This is the final moment of our last days. Release and cease. beating yourself into submission. Remember that fake Frederick Douglass quote about slavery from the Dehumanizer episode? Well, this is Cult of Luna saying no one can beat you into submission. They have to find a way to make you do it to yourself. And the lyrics continue. With poisoned blood, the demon speaks. See how the wolves devour the weak. They will not inherit. Okay, so now we're picking up some themes, right? Intronaut describes humans at war as sheep, absorbing the literal black cloud of unrestricted violence through their skin, while Cult of Luna envisions a demon poisoning the blood of humanity, whispering about the wolves that will inherit the world by devouring it. It's just fascinating to me that consciously I'm grouping these songs together because I think they all describe a similar process or operation of human nature. And now, this interplay of imagery about wolves and sheep that I wasn't even aware of starts revealing itself through the comparison. I just love shit like that. It feels like someone pulling back the curtain of the universe just to wink at you. My guess is Scottish film actor Robert Carlyle. So let's keep going. Now we have another Swedish band, Graveyard, with some clean vocals, as promised. And as you can hear, these guys come out of a blues metal revival that was happening in Sweden around the mid to late 2000s and produced three of my favorite modern metal acts, the doomy and melodic Witchcraft, take one, who are simultaneously awesome and occasionally sincere to the point of being goofy. They also cannot pronounce the word macabre without utilizing the R. Macabre. On the bluesier end is the untouchably great and virtually unknown Asteroid alongside Graveyard. I have to find a reason to play Asteroid on this pod before too long because they are just such a hidden gem. They have three records, a self-titled debut, and two follow-ups titled 2 and 3. And Asteroid 2 is one of those hear this before you die records. Seriously. Go listen to Asteroid 2. But back to Graveyard. This song comes off of their third record, Lights Out, which opens with the track I just played, An Industry of Murder. It's definitely the least abstract of the four songs, and about as metal as their discography gets. Here are some of the words. Shipping boys to slaughter, but you're sparing your own sons. Their families are shattered while you cash your checks in blood. An industry of murder, scratching the right backs. Watch out for the bombs. Here comes a new attack. Industry of Murder is the only song of the four that does not include a reference to sheep and or wolves. But the metaphor was clearly top of mind on this album, as the second single on similar themes, Goliath, begins with the line, "The wolves are at your door, dressed like sheep." And the first verse of the song, which you also didn't hear, reads like this. Wherever you go, death follows, in the shadow of your step, waiting, lurking like a vulture. See them feeding on the souls, which is weirdly similar to the line from Cult of Luna, see the wolves devour the weak. There's a commonality in both songs, asking the listener to see or watch as one animal feeds on another. It's deliberately gruesome imagery, but it's also a natural act made unnatural as a metaphor for humans feeding on other humans. Yes, we need to eat to survive, but that permission structure of total war perverts our biological impulses into some kind of cannibalism. And in order to make the leap from one act to the other, you have to be shown how. We have to see it happen, because we would likely never come to that conclusion on our own. It's like hate. Total war has to be taught. In I, the Weapon, it's a lesson about who will inherit the future. In other words, if you don't eat them, they will eat you. And this particular demon compels us through fear. Now listen to this last line from Graveyard. Pain and constant suffering comes from their kind. They always try to rule us, letting fear control your mind. Just to be clear what they're talking about, as Graveyard says earlier, with the proper lies, the public folds. It's all out war. And finally, who better to take that metaphor and extend it to its superlatively illogical conclusion but the paragon of protest music, the Grammy award-winning environmental pioneers out of Angers? The French prog monsters awakened and empowered after many years of nuclear radiation at the depths of the Pacific Ocean? Gojira! The song I played is called, wait for it, Wolf Down the Earth. the penultimate track off of what I consider to be their magnum opus, The Way of All Flesh. Many will tell you that their previous record, From Mars to Sirius, is actually the band's creative peak, and while I love From Mars to Sirius, I don't take that argument to be serious. See, the album's called From Mars. Hey, let's just finish the medley, and I can get into that later. So now that we've enumerated and elucidated some of these themes here, let me read you these lyrics from Wolf Down the Earth and let you put duh and duh together. They teach you how to conquer all the world. The towers that you built so strong, no man can touch. They tell you how to find and raise the fears and let them grow inside of your heart. They need no walls. And this is one of my favorite lines in the entire Gojira discography. Remember, see the wolves devour the weak and see them feeding on the souls? This is why Gojira is next level shit. Check this out. Behold the bright lights coming down on time. Inside the womb, the new blood gets ready to fight. Wolf down the one that made us all. No hope, you wolf down the earth. There it is again, the impulse to devour, motivated by hopelessness or fear. Briefly returning to our science metaphor here, if we were to come up with a hypothesis to answer the question, how is total war made possible, based solely on a lyrical analysis of four songs by heavy metal bands with no authoritative historical or psychological credentials other than being super brutal, I think it might be something like this. Total war is the result of one population's existential fear of another, and by instilling in that population the false belief that resolution is only possible through the consumption of their enemies. Yum, yum. I think a sort of implied corollary to that idea is that belligerents, as the warring nations were called in World War I, have to be willing to commit acts that their rivals are not. I don't want to get too mired in philosophy here, but it's kind of like Batman. It would be really easy for him to just kill the Joker and all of his henchmen and be done with it. But then what separates Batman from the Joker? He would also have to kill the Penguin and the Riddler and all of their henchmen, Colonel Blimp. Okay, Batman should totally kill Colonel Blimp. No one would even notice, honestly. So, Rogues Gallery tangent aside, I think it's really illuminating that an American jazz sludge band, Swedish post-metal band, Swedish blues metal band, and French prog metal band, frog metal band? At various moments in time decided to try to dig down into the human impulse for war and more or less came to the same conclusion. Total war is not a natural consequence of human conflict. There is a reason that it took us 200,000 plus 1805 years to get around to it. It's an unnatural mutation in the evolution of warfare because total war isn't conquest for the benefit of its people. It subverts the prioritization of people to the war itself. Survival is a natural process of life. Total war, at its basis, is mutual annihilation. It's the antithesis of survival. And to try to bring this all back around to the subject at hand, Genghis Khan probably introduced the concept of total war. Napoleon then experimented with and developed it, and World War I scaled it up to something that was previously unimaginable to humans. You could make the further argument that in two decades, World War II would follow the blueprint of total war and ultimately perfect it. Okay, who needs a break? Oh good, me too. And when we come back, we will dive right back into World War I with the Miracle on the Marne, trench warfare, mustard gas, and all the other nicknames I earned in college. So get ready, because this shit's about to get heavy. I just settled on my lawsuits. Fuck you, Debbie. When we come back.